This is Jim Pepper, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Today I'm pleased to announce that we have a double feature, the first hour. My guest will be Lauren Moray, whom I had on as a guest last week. The second hour, Judy Wood, who has new research to present. Lauren is an independent scientist. She's been an expert witness at the Kyoto International Tribune for War Crimes in Afghanistan, a speaker at the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Conference. She earned her B.S. in geology at UC Davis in 68, her M.A. in Near Eastern Studies from Berkeley in 78. She's completed all but her dissertation for the geosciences at Davis. She's traveled and conducted scientific research in 42 countries. She contributed to a scientific report on depleted uranium for the United Nations Subcommission investigating the legality of depleted uranium munitions, which, of course, turns out to be non-existent. They're clearly not legal. She's an expert on radioactive fallout, rainout, and deeply involved in radiation issues. Lauren, it's a great pleasure to have you back on the Dynamic Duo.
Thank you. How are you today?
Just very fine, thank you. I wanted to mention for our listeners' benefit that if they go to 911scholars.org, go to events, then for my previous visit with you on 14 June, you'll find four different articles, My Lauren Archive, there, and we're going to talk about some of those today. And then I'm anticipating having Lauren back after her trips for the rest of this month. So in July, I hope to have her back. Lauren, one of your depleted uranium studies just utterly fascinate me, but also they're so incredibly disconcerting, even in some ways frightening. I'm looking at your piece on depleted uranium, the Trojan horse of nuclear war. Here you have a diagram of Brzezinski's map of the Eurasian chessboard, which is from his grand chessboard published in 1997, where Zbigniew talked about how the United States, as the sole remaining superpower, had the opportunity to create a worldwide empire, the plan that would be outlined in greater detail by the Project for the New American Century, including Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Feith, all these guys who came into government and then began to implement that plan. And I take it that you're finding the use of radioactive, of depleted uranium is consistent with this master plan for creating an American empire worldwide.
Well, it's really the Zionist Anglo-American economic empire. And we're just kind of really the military proxy for the British throne and the London money tower. And the real shadow government in the United States is Skull and Bones, which is the secret society at Yale. Those are the sons of the Wall Street banking establishment. And so it's the money men who are really behind all of this.
Let's talk a bit about the use of depleted uranium in the Middle East. Of course, it's justified on the ground that because it's such a dense material, you can make weapons that will penetrate many inches of steel, and therefore it's a fantastic anti-tank weapon, but it's also phenomenal in other respects because it causes so much damage to human beings. Here, for example, you have a list of known illnesses inflicted by the internalization of depleted uranium particles. This is very scary stuff, Lauren.
Yes, it is. There are other materials that can be used to destroy things. And the technologies of warfare since World War II, a lot of this came out of the Agent Orange, depleted uranium, and the atomic bombs, came out of the Manhattan Project and the nuclear power program. So all of these horrific technologies utilizing radiation are being used to reshape our society, to depopulate the planet by 2 to 4 billion people. And that's not a wild assertion. That is actually stated in the memos of the National Security Council. It's a Kissinger quote. And he stated that depopulation is of a higher priority to the U.S. Economy than even the nuclear weapons program. That was in 1978.
You know, Lauren, that really makes these people, you know, people like Kissinger out to be really true moral monsters. Not that it's not beyond the realm of imagination, obviously.
Well, we already knew that.
What, what's the rationale for depopulation? It's to reduce the draw on the Earth's carrying capacity. I mean, having studied this before, I know there are, are books that report that if you wanted to have a sustainable population, a population that could live indefinitely, using the Earth's carrying capacity, its resources, that at the same level of quality of life as American citizens, that it couldn't sustain more than 2 billion. Is that approximately the rationale for pursuing these plans?
No, that is absolutely nonsense. If they return, I have a master's degree in archaeology also. If they utilized ancient agricultural technologies which evolved to adapt to the local plants and microclimate, they could produce 10 times as much food as they're producing now with World Bank agricultural technologies, and it would be at least 5 times more nutritious.
Well, of course, that's an excellent point, because there are several, you know, multiple variables involved, and if you can increase the productivity of agriculture, that would be a giant step in the direction of creating a base, a carrying capacity for a larger population that might be sustainable.
The whole depopulation theory came out of the 1700s. It's called the Malthusian theory. Malthus was a very wealthy academic unknown in Britain in the 1700s, and he came up with the depopulation theory, which was total baloney because there certainly wasn't overpopulation then. And this has sort of been propelled forward through the British Empire, and the Rockefellers brought it to the United States in the 1920s. They were also funding the institute where Mengele trained before he became a Nazi operator. And this has been a very popular theory. All of these wealthy elites sit around and talk about it all the time, and they have for several hundred years. So
is it rooted in racism, or is it simply greed, power, wanting to own more and more of what's available?
When they want access to mineral resources and other resources, timber and everything, people living there, indigenous people especially, are very inconvenient. And the reason they've used vast amounts of depleted uranium in the Middle East and Central Asia is to completely poison the environment of those regions and to guarantee the slow decline of any populations living, inhabiting those areas. Now, another thing that's happened is that the Navy, 3 or 4 years ago, Admiral Bobby Ray Inman suddenly appeared at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. He was on a secret committee no one knew about.
Hold that thought, Lauren. We'll be right back with my special guest, Lauren Murray. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. We have a double feature today. My guest of the first hour is Lauren Murray, an independent scientist and expert on many subjects, but including depleted uranium. The second hour, Judy Wood with new research. So stand by for that, too. Lauren, you were talking about...
the Navy.
Yes.
Yes. What we're faced with now is a complete takeover by the Navy, and I've been watching this for 5 years. First... Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, who's a very well-known spook in the U.S. government, appeared at the Jet Propulsion Lab, and he went in and hijacked that whole project, and the control of NASA is now under the U.S. Navy. Few people know that the Navy detonated at least 2 or 3 nuclear bombs in the Van Allen belts, which are the the field lines of the magnetic field and protect the Earth from cosmic radiation. So that tipped me off. Then I started going to UC nuclear weapons, UC Regents meetings to monitor the nuclear weapons program, because there was a contract change for the first time in 61 years. And there was Admiral Linton Brooks from DOE, the Nuclear Weapons Office, and there was an Admiral Pete Foley in the UC President's Vice President's Office, and then they put an admiral in charge of Los Alamos, the nuclear weapons lab. And I wondered why the Navy was all over the nuclear weapons lab. Well, they've sort of pretty much taken it over with private contractors who are now in partnership with the University of California. The next thing I noticed, I was in Hawaii in May, and Admiral Mullen, who was the head of the Navy, gave a bunch of really horrible speeches saying we were going to be in Afghanistan and Iraq for a generation. So everything they're saying about pulling the troops out is just all bald-faced lies. They have no intention of leaving. And what is happening now is Admiral Mullen is now been nominated by Bush to become the chief of staff of all of the military. So basically, the Navy removed depleted uranium from the military, their military arsenal in 1989 out of concern about environmental impacts and probably the impact it would have on their own men. And the ground-based military have now been turned into uranium meat. So the Army and the Marine Corps and some of the Air Force actually are very, very sick now. The Navy's in fine shape, and they're moving in to take over all of the military. Now, if he's saying we're not getting out for a generation and they poisoned the whole world with depleted uranium in order to secure the mineral resources and depopulate the world, I think people need to start waking up and investigating why are they doing this, who is behind it, and the most famous and the best question of all to ask is, cui bono, who benefits?
The idea of the Navy taking over the whole military is a little difficult to envision as a former Marine Corps officer. I mean, each of the services have a different function, you know, the Army for ground-based warfare, the Marine Corps really basically amphibious assaults, but all used for various other functions. Then the Air Force obviously control of the skies, the Navy the seas. I mean, unless the Navy were to have a branch that would perform those other functions, in a literal sense, it can't be the case that the Navy could take over the military. So what you mean is something like, from the point of view of command and control, the directive, because some key naval officers are being put in these very important positions.
Well, there's an admiral now in charge of Iraq and Afghanistan. So, I mean, come on, Jim, if we have admirals all over the place like wallpaper, then what is really going on? I asked Major Doug Rocky 2 days ago why Mullen was being moved in as chief of staff of the entire military, Admiral Mullen. He said, Loren, Pace was fired. Of course, he was a Marine general in charge of Iraq for a number of years. And he said they're moving in the bad guys now who will do what they want them to do.
Well, that doesn't that's not inconsistent with my conception of this administration. That's certainly true. They're putting in people that they think are going to be very obedient and willing, for example, to nuke Iran. Was your source there suggesting that was one of the items on the immediate agenda?
I think they're not going to knock that beehive over. If they nuke Iran, it's going to end up with the Straits of Hormuz blocked, which is the only way you can get in and out of the Persian Gulf. And it's going to have oil prices skyrocketing all over the world. It's going to bankrupt countries. And the consequences of that would be devastating to the United States, not just other countries as well. So I think there's a lot of saber rattling, and we're poking at Iran, but I think there's horse trading going on in that region between the U.S. and Russia and India, and, I mean, think about what big players are there, China. It has something to do with that.
Well, I like that. That makes a lot of sense. Besides, Iran is so well fortified with the Sunburn and other short of ship missiles. It seems
to be extremely
hazardous for a Navy to attack Iran.
It would be horrific. But let me read the quote by Admiral Michael Mullen that was in the Hawaii Honolulu Star Bulletin on Wednesday, May 9th, 2007. He said about combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, quote, "The enemy now is basically evil and fundamentally hates everything we are. The democratic principles for which we stand for, this war is going to go on for a long time."
Yeah, but that's a purely ideological statement, as you well know. I mean, that has no basis in fact.
Jim, can I finish?
Sure, hang on. This is my special guest, Lauren Morey. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is Lauren Morey, who's an expert in geosciences and a student of the geopolitical landscape. Four of her articles are archived on 911scholars.org under events. Scroll down to 14 June, and you'll find Planet Earth as Weapon and Target, Depleted Uranium, the Trojan Horse of Nuclear War, the Queen's Death Star, and From Hiroshima to Iraq, 61 Years of Uranium Wars, a suicidal, genocidal, and omnicidal course. And I just must reiterate, Lauren, that reading your articles really gives me a creepy feeling. It's very depressing because considering just, for example, that the half-life of depleted uranium is 4.5 billion years, which is equal to the age of the Earth, what we're talking about is the creating vast, permanently uninhabitable areas of the Earth and contributing to the extinction of the species.
Well, that's exactly why I'm doing this. I've worked in two nuclear weapons labs. Actually, I'm a Quaker. I'm totally against violence and certainly most totally against war. And, of course, I never knew what a nuclear weapon was when I worked in those laboratories of death, of the Brotherhood of Death. First, I worked at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, and this was when the citizens of Berkeley in the 70s were fighting for a nuclear weapons-free zone, and the University of California actually had businessmen murdered who were supporting the citizens and doing fundraisers for them. So we're talking about very high stakes and very extreme measures that are being taken and were being taken by people who you can certainly certify them as total social sociopaths. There's no doubt. And unfortunately, that is who is representing much of our leadership today. But I'm not saying this, and I didn't write those articles to depress people.
Well,
the world.
I understand.
The world.
I mean, it's just that we're in a situation where I think a rational response to a situation of the kind you're describing is depression, because the situation is so dire. The consequences are so serious, and the probabilities of being able to rectify it are so remote.
That's not why I'm doing it. The world turns on information, and you cannot take actions that are effective unless you have the right information. They have the right information. They're doing total surveillance on everyone every day, 24 hours a day. That's what those underground computers, acres of them, are for at Langley, Virginia, under the CIA. So if we don't have the right information, we cannot possibly act in an effective way. And there's no choice anymore. These technologies are so lethal and deadly and so global that we have to stop them. And I think we can. That's why I'm doing this. I'm not depressed or discouraged at all. I think it's when I shifted to working from a spiritual center with spiritual energy that gets recharged by the people around you, that's when I became my most effective. And my job is to go around the world and inform people and to empower them to begin to act against this nightmare. I mean, there's just a very small group who has created this global disaster, and there are a whole lot more of us, 6 billion people who certainly don't want to be the victims of this sociopathy. And the only way that we can begin to act against them and stop it is by knowing what the real situation is.
I agree completely. Listen, incidentally, in relation to your quote, all I meant was that those statements about them hating us and our freedom are the kind of things that were attributed to, you know, Osama bin Laden. And then it was, of course,
for purely propagandistic purposes.
Pardon me?
I'd like to know what democratic principles he's talking about when we have the president taking out attorneys, district attorneys who are honest and doing their job, when all the elections are rigged with electronic voting machines. And by the way, it was Admiral Bobby Ray Inman and Admiral John Poindexter, the 4 or 5 times convicted felon, they're the ones who wrote the security software for the Sequoia voting machine system and some others at SAIC, Science Application International Corporation. And that was started by a physicist called Dr. Beister from Los Alamos. So the nuke labs and the Department of Energy and the military are all involved in all of this. It's called the Iron Triangle. It's politicians, the military-industrial complex, and I forgot what the third arm of it is. But
I certainly agree about the role of surveillance and the electronic voting machines, which I frequently discuss and have experts on to dissect. So, I mean, I couldn't agree more with that.
Well, people have to know about it. I went to Hawaii in October. I wanted them to introduce a depleted uranium bill. I started a movement 2 years ago to get state legislatures to introduce DU bills, and it was to push from the bottom up on Congress and the administration and the Pentagon to start doing something for our sick soldiers. The medical disability rate is over 55% since 1991. Everybody's coming home and dying. And then they internally contaminate their wives and partners and their children because it leaks out in their sweat. It's in their semen. This is a nightmare. And it's being, the healthcare costs are dumped on the state and county medical facilities.
Is there enough depleted uranium already distributed there that as it makes its way around the world, it has the potential to severely compromise the prospects for survival of the species?
Of course. And what is happening is the same idiots who are making these decisions to go to war, making the decisions to develop and use these horrific technologies, and then selling these weapons, the Carlyle Group made most of their beginning startup money on depleted uranium weapons. And these CEOs or these people, these decision makers, are also the former CEOs or present CEOs of pharmaceutical companies. So they're selling the weapons, clobbering all these countries and stealing their natural resources, making the whole world sick, selling the medicine that doesn't even work, and they're just absolutely pigs feeding at the public trough.
Yeah, we're talking about what they call the New World Order, are we not? And it's basically a globalization in a particularly virulent form.
It's actually communism being carried out, the original concept of communism, by the same people. It's people like Al Gore's family, Jacob Schiff's family. Jacob Schiff was a wealthy New Yorker who funded the Bolsheviks. Gore's daughter is married to Jacob Schiff's grandson.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Lauren Moray. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. We have a double feature today. This is my last segment with Lauren Moray, an independent scientist, expert witness of the Tokyo International Tribunal for War Crimes in Afghanistan, speaker at the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Conference, expert on geosciences, interested in many subjects. The second hour, we'll have Judy Wood with new research. Lauren, this is just a terminological point, but I think classic communism is actually a propertyless society where nobody has control, but everyone shares in common. So I think really what you're talking about is far more like a fascist or a totalitarian society where a small group is in control of everything.
Oh, well, yes, it's communism for us and extreme capitalism for them. And this is why they want to depopulate. They want to control the mineral resources, the water. They want a slave population, basically, and there are just too many people for them to handle now.
Is this tied in with the development of a North American Union and, reducing the significance of national boundaries and the immigration bill?
Yeah, in order to create one global government, they have to consolidate regions first under a regional government and then put those bigger and bigger pieces of the pie together until they have the whole pie. When I went to India and I was speaking to the top intellectuals and top level of the government with Alfred Levermont Weber, I took him on a speaking tour with me after the Kuala Lumpur conference in February and March. We went to New Delhi, and J.C. Kapoor, who is the publisher and editor of the World Affairs Journal, which I write for, told me, he said, Loren, 4 or 5 U.S. agricultural corporations just came to India and told the Indian government that they wanted to take over agriculture in India, and that they only needed 2 million Indian farmers. And the Indian government said, well, what are we going to do with the other 147 million Indian farmers? And the corporation said, well, that's your problem. And what I told them is that all of this DU that's blowing around the world is blowing over the Himalayas. It's being rained and snowed out into the Himalayas. It's blowing all over India. And that they're actually being nuked, they're downwinders from all these uranium wars in the Middle East and Central Asia. And sure enough, their diabetes rates are skyrocketing in northern India, which is where the big agricultural plain is, and the DU is killing off their farmers. So,
isn't it also going to kill off the crops?
No, they're just contaminated, but that's good because then everybody gets colon cancer and they die off.
Good from the point of view of population reduction.
Oh, yeah. Good from the point of view of the agricultural corporations who want to take over. And the, the model all these centuries, all these millennia has been the lord or the ruling elite on top. And they stand on two legs, the military and the underworld, the criminal element. Those are the criminal element and the underworld. Organized crime and the military keep the ruling elite in power. Otherwise, none of us would put up with this. And so what is happening now in the U.S., it's very obvious, is that This police state is being implemented, and the model for it was actually developed as the Phoenix program in Vietnam, and of course that's why Oliver North is so popular in Republican circles and supported by the military, because he's actually the one who set up FEMA, the Federal Emergency Military Agency, and was building concentration camps then in the United States.
You mean Oliver North?
Who did I say?
Oliver Stone.
No, Oliver North.
Yeah.
Oliver North. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah, Oliver North. And so he's a convicted criminal, too, and what is he? He's practically running for office. I mean, he's all over television. He's a hero in America. Huh?
The Phoenix program was assassinating leaders in villages and so forth.
No, it was much more than that. It was destroying the civilian support of the Viet Cong resistance. And Homeland Security is exactly and precisely modeled on the Phoenix program. And Colonel, what was his name, the first, Tom Ridge, was in the Phoenix program in Vietnam, and he just happened to be the first Secretary of Homeland Security.
He also seemed to me like such a dim bulb, you know. I mean, he looked great, but he had the mind, the brain of a peanut.
Well, that's who they like.
Yeah, tell me how this Homeland Security works on the model of the Phoenix. I'm very interested in that.
Well, we have over 800 concentration camps built now in the United States. Halliburton had a lot to do with it. They got a lot of the contracts to not only refurbish the former Japanese and German concentration camps used in World War II, but they've built new ones. There's a huge one outside of Las Vegas. It's completely empty. I talk about this wherever I go, and people come up and say, oh, I worked on the railroad cars. We were welding leg irons and restraints into these railroad cars, or I worked on that concentration camp. It's right there next to the airport, blah, blah, blah. And this is a reality.
How long have those been in the works, Lauren?
Oh, probably 10 or 15 years.
I'm just worried, because that required, you know, government funding, presumably, and therefore,
sure.
Are we going back to the Reagan-Bush administration?
Well, sure. And that's what the whole drug industry is for in the United States. It's the CIA cash cow. It's the cash flow through the U.S.
Well,
economy.
Do you think there was a major turn in this direction when Reagan was president, given that he probably had so little understanding of what was going on and Bush was basically running the show?
The major turn in the U.S. is when Kennedy, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King were assassinated.
And Bobby, yeah.
That was done by the dream breakers, and those were the dream makers. And that's a great book. If you want to read it, it's the biography of Thurgood Marshall.
This is the dream breakers.
The dream makers and the dream breakers, and it's the bad guys killing off the good guys. It's what he saw from the viewpoint of the U.S. Supreme Court as the first black man who served. And Carl Rowan wrote that book. He went to Thurgood Marshall's home for 20 years, and they would have these long talks and drink and swear and everything in the kitchen. And Rowan based the book on those kitchen conversations.
Well, I'm a huge fan of Thurgood Marshall, and certainly that concept of dream makers and dream breakers is a very fitting one. I don't want for you to get away today without telling us what you think can be done constructively to cope with the problems you're describing, because they are so overwhelming that it's difficult to get a clear sense of what to do about it.
It's real simple. Take the profit out of war. And number one is we need to change our energy choices and quit being hostages of the petroleum industry. When I worked at the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab and became a whistleblower, Richard Berta was the Western Regional Inspector for the Inspector General's Office at DOE. And I went to him to blow the whistle. He said, Loren, the nuclear weapons labs exist for the Pentagon, and the Pentagon exists for the oil companies. We need to decentralize food, water, and energy.
Lauren, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show again. I wish you well at the conference in Vancouver and look forward to talking with you again. Have a great trip.
We'll have a lot more to say when I get back.
Thank you. Thank you so very much. I look forward to it.
Thank you, Jim.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. We'll be right back with my second special guest today, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. During the second hour, it's a special pleasure to welcome as my guest, the leading scientist in 9/11 research, who has degrees in civil engineering with a specialty in structural, in engineering mechanics, also known as applied physics, and in material structure science, which appear to be the three disciplines most importantly related to research on the events at the World Trade Center. Her name is Judy Wood, and it's a pleasure to welcome you back to the show, Judy.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here. One correction, materials engineering science.
Materials engineering science. Good. Now, Judy has a new web page we're going to discuss. I want to give you the address. It's drjudywood.com/. So it's drjudywood.com/. Dirt, the word dirt, D-I-R-T, and the numeral 4, dirt4.html. I'll repeat that, drjudywood.com/dirt4.html. And if that won't work for you, there's a backup link, which is www.911scholarsreview.org, www.911scholarsreview.org/dirt4.html. I'll repeat that one last time, 911scholarsreview.org/dirt4.html. Judy, this looks like pretty interesting stuff.
Thanks. I understand Tripod has been doing something strange that affects people with Windows machines that use Internet Explorer. They cannot access my site, apparently.
Really? Internet Explorer? Is that a function of operating systems?
Yes. I have a Mac, and other people I know have Macintosh. It doesn't affect them.
Yeah, I have Macs.
But Internet Explorer on Windows machines...
I think we ought to recommend anyone who has Internet Explorer, if you have a different browser available, try it. You'll like it. It'll make a difference. Judy, where shall we begin? I love this molecular dissociation from dust to dirt.
Well, I've talked about the dirt being used as the cover-up, literally covering up.
Yeah, that's right. Very literally, no doubt. This is, covering up, like covering up a body, covering up a crime.
And that's how they cover up chemical spills. And there is an aspect of this, I believe, that is chemical.
Yeah, tell us more.
It's a combination, and that we can talk about tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah, let me mention to everybody, I'm having Judy back for the full show tomorrow. So you're going to have, we're going to have her for the second hour today and then for the full program, the whole 2 hours tomorrow. Continue.
Okay, on this, on the Dirt 4 page, I call it the Cheeto page. Sort of making fun of this picture that we call the Cheeto picture. It is this looks like a Cheeto.
In the lower left.
Yeah. Stephen Jones has shown us quite a bit. And as far as I know, that's the only source for this picture. I haven't seen that come from anywhere else. I haven't seen it on any of the government websites I've trolled through, et cetera.
It's a huge backhoe, but you've corrected me and told me there's a technical name for this kind of equipment, which is?
It's a grappler.
A grappler.
Yep. That's to call these diggers, but the correct term is grappler.
Sounds like the name of a superhero or villain.
Yeah, it looks like it grabs things. In the beginning of this page, I show that picture in the Cheetos. If you click on it, you get the fire hot Cheetos. But I don't believe this is hot. Because if that grappler is operational, it can't be operational for much longer if it's that hot. And all of this, what looks like steam around there.
Yeah.
It's a chemical reaction coming up. I call it fuming. The ground is fuming.
Fuming. Very good. See, now there's a concept again. It's like your dustification, fuming. That's what we need is enough concepts to get our mind around what's really going on.
And on the first page, the dirt one, I don't know if I mentioned, I'm going to be trying to move my website soon because of these problems that are coming up.
Yes.
But on the first page, dirt one, I have that glossary, vocabulary list. And I also point out that if we don't know exactly what the process is, you bias your observations by naming it something inappropriate.
Sure, of course.
So you can call it event 1A/52B or whatever, but
yeah.
We might as well just give it a name we can remember.
Sure.
These names are of particular, I'm identifying particular phenomena that are occurring.
Well, the use of loaded language is a very powerful effect, well known to propagandists and advertisers and politicians.
Yes, and that's what we're going to talk about today. This being presented as molten metal is one of the biggest psyops of this whole 9/11 event.
Continue.
As you notice right below figure 110, I have a new section called The Story About Hydraulics. And
yeah.
You can look it up in engineering handbooks. It's on the web everywhere. And I'll go ahead and read the first sentence. Hydraulic fluid temperatures above
82C, which is only 180 degree F, damage most steel compounds and accelerate oil degradation. A single over temperature event of sufficient magnitude could permanently damage all the seals in an entire hydraulic system. Judy, there's no way then that hydraulic system couldn't have been completely incapacitated if that actually were molten metal. I mean,
correct.
Surely it would have had to have elevated the temperature of the system above 180 degrees F, which isn't even the boiling point of water.
Correct. And you saw the pictures, and I have plenty of them on this page, where the grappler is out in the middle of the pile, ground zero.
Yeah.
And the time it takes one of those to drive out there to the middle, it wouldn't survive. It couldn't get that far if it was hot.
Yeah, it would stall. It would freeze up. It would lose its seals. If it loses its seals, then, of course, you lose all the hydraulic fluid.
Right, and it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And it's damaged. You got to take it to the shop. So this, there's no way that this could be hot. So what are we looking at? This is the cover story for a lot of things. It's the cover story for the fuming coming out of the ground.
Yeah, I think that was indispensable. I mean, you know, and smoke, obviously, that it's smoke from molten metal is such a plausible story if you don't know better.
Well, that's right. People need an explanation. You give an explanation, then they quit looking further.
Right.
So when you introduce them to a picture, you tell them what it means, and then they don't look at what it really shows.
Yes.
That's a big psychological trick that gets used. I have some more examples at the very bottom of this page.
Okay.
Should we go there?
Wherever, Judy. I'm with you.
Let's go to the very bottom of the page, a couple pictures up, and there's figure 135 and 136. Figure 135.
Yeah.
I took from the original. I cut out the same section that Stephen Jones showed in his February 1 talk in 2006. It was the first time people would have seen this dustifying spire. It's been called a spire. It's part of the core that's remaining.
I thought it was probably some of the external. You think it's actually a part of the core?
It's part of the core.
Is it really?
And because...
Hey, we'll come back to these fascinating pictures, and with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. Today with my special guest, my all-time favorite guest, Judy Wood, the leading expert on scientific issues related to 9/11 and especially the devastation of the World Trade Center. We're dishing the dirt. We're on page, a special page she's just created, which you can find at the following link, Dr. Judy Wood, drjudywood.com/dirt4.html. drjudywood.com/dirt4html, and we're looking at photographs at the bottom of the page, figures 135 and 136. Judy.
When we were first shown this picture by Stephen Jones, he showed us the version of it on the right. The original is on the left.
Really?
And what he showed us...
So there's been a substantial darkening to the color tones to accent these little whitish things.
Yes, and notice you don't see much of the spire that's turning to dust.
That's true.
Darkened out.
Much more obscure.
And he drew our attention to those horizontal pieces on the left side that are streaming dust.
Yeah.
He said that that's evidence of thermite.
According to him.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
The average person doesn't know what thermite's supposed to look like, so it trains them to look at this picture and see thermite.
Uh-huh.
They see this, even if they see the correct contrast.
It's like I handed you a bunch of pennies and said to you, gold, and you don't know what gold is, and you're looking at these pennies, and you're assuming that they are gold.
I'll continue to call them gold. That's what I start thinking. And I have a link there to Rick Siegel's video, and you can also see other images in the video that he filmed of the spire turning to dust. And they didn't want people to see that. So it appears that the contrast was deliberately, you know, increased tremendously. The pictures hardly look the same, but everything matches up. They're the same shape.
Sure.
Yeah, these white specks.
Oh, and sure.
The pictures right below that, the same type thing.
Affecting the contrast and the color. Yeah, go on, yeah.
Now, figure 137 is the original, and 138 is what was in Stephen Jones's paper.
You think the original is an authentic photograph?
It could be that the brightness is kind of funny. One thing I noticed in the left corner of this picture, it looks like a flashlight aiming up from somebody's pocket. And that doesn't appear in the other one.
No, it doesn't.
But one thing you'll notice is that fellow in the blue shirt at the back,
right,
he's standing down in the hole.
He's actually in the hole.
He's in the hole. And the guy with the black hat might also be, but clearly the guy with the blue shirt is standing in that hole.
Look how the guy with the hat, his hat is sort of floating above his head.
Right. This isn't hot, but we're being trained to think there's all sorts of evidence of molten metal.
The composition of this is very suspicious to me, Judy. It looks a lot like the way an artist would arrange a painting.
That could be true as well. We can only see what we see, but there are pictures where you're taking at night.
Yeah.
Have longer exposure time, so the brighter areas will saturate the film.
Now, if there's a flashlight, of course, that obviously implies somebody was below flashing a light upward.
Or it's stuck in the ground or something like that.
Yeah, okay. Very interesting. Where should we go from here?
Back up to the top.
Okay.
Back up, we left off with that chart.
Just below the Cheetos, below the hydraulic story.
Right.
We're getting some quotes here from debunking 9/11 debunking.
Correct. And would you like to read the excerpt from page 314?
Sure. It was, however, in relation to the issue of molten metal that Jim Dwyer, New York Times, most fully displayed his ignorance of crucial facts. Pointing out that Steve Jones had argued that, quote, the molten metal found in the rubble was evidence of demolition explosives because an ordinary airplane fire would not generate enough heat, Dwyer gave the final word to the director of Protec, a demolition monitoring firm, who said that, quote, if there had been any molten steel in the rubble, it would have permanently damaged any excavation equipment encountering it. And, of course, we know that that appears to be correct because, for example, as you've shown with the grappler, those temperatures would have been so high they would have destroyed the hydraulic system. Shall I read page 215?
Just one more detail. Notice if fires can't do this from airplanes, then it must be thermite.
I refer to that as a specious bifurcation. You're presented two alternatives as though they were mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive. Bush does this when he says you're either with us or you're with the terrorist, although there were no in-between, which might be a more, a nuanced or qualified position of being critical about the terrorists and wanting to do something intelligent about them as opposed to invading Afghanistan and Iraq.
It's a thought control type of wording.
Oh, yeah, it's a very clever. It's a mode of mental manipulation.
Want to continue, for 315.
Okay. We have here an extreme example of the tendency to favor a priori arguments over empirical evidence. As we saw in Chapter 3, the testimony to the existence of molten metal in the rubble is so strong as to put the issue completely beyond doubt. Well, Judy, when I read this sentence in the book, I was very troubled because a priori arguments are arguments that are completely independent of experience. There are kinds of a priori arguments where we don't need to refer to experience in order to establish the truth of a claim, such as that bachelors are unmarried, roses are flowers, Volkswagens are automobiles. Those are a priori because given the language framework that we're employing, it cannot fail to be the case that roses are flowers or Volkswagens are automobiles. But when he referred here to a priori arguments, when he's talking about somebody who has a vast amount of experience, the director of ProTech, a demolition monitoring firm, for example, that's not a priori at all. So it's not a priori over empirical. Really, he's talking about expert sources over empirical evidence, but he's also taking for granted that what's been offered as empirical evidence actually so qualifies. So this was actually, to tell you the truth, of all the of the parts that I've read of this book, this sentence bothered me more than any other, so I find it fascinating that it's included among your quotes.
Now, you see my comment in response to it.
Yeah, Griffin seems to be saying, all I need is the testimony of people on the government payroll, the same government that committed the atrocities of 9/11. But, of course, that's making a presumption. That's assuming that the testimony is from someone on the government payroll, and in this case, that points in a certain direction where it's, that could be interpreted as a question-begging assumption.
In your reading, and what who is on the payroll, who he's relying on, those payrolls.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Thursday today, I'm here with my special guest, Judy Wood. We're doing 1 hour today and 2 hours tomorrow, so I want you all to come back. We're talking about a new page she's developed on the dirt, which you can find at the following link, drjudywood.com/dirt4.html. That's drjudywood.com, all lowercase, slash, dirt, lowercase, numeral 4.html. And Judy, we're down to the third of these three quotes from debunking 9/11, debunking. Shall I read this quote now?
Yes, continue.
In one of these statements, moreover, Gregory Fuchel said, quote, sometimes when a worker would pull a steel beam from the wreckage, the end of the beam would be dripping molten steel, end quote. Evidently, this worker's crane was not, quote, permanently damaged, end quote. Dwyer was writing a story for the New York Times, which likes to think of itself as having the highest standards of excellence. But he apparently did not check to see if the evidence supported Jones rather than the man from ProTech, even though a Google search for molten metal at Ground Zero would have turned up over 300,000 items, many of which contain the testimonies of the people quoted in Chapter 3, such as Peter Tilley, Mark Lizzo, and Leslie Robertson.
Those three people are on the government payroll.
Yeah, I'm worried about those sources. And, of course, you're absolutely right when you say the number of hits on an item on Google is not really decisive other than as indication of how many hits there are on that item and possible interest in that item. But this is not a very persuasive argument. I just don't know if David is really just not familiar with the arguments on the other side. These are passages that seem to be missing the mark, some by a considerable margin. As I say, especially the tendency about a priori arguments when we're talking about someone who's actually a subject or domain expert. Continue.
If we look at the people on the government payroll, Tully, Lizzo, and Robertson.
Yeah. How's Robertson on the payroll, Judy? I know he used to be in the engineering firm, of course, with...
He was part of directing the cleanup. And you hear this number about 1.2 trillion tons of debris were removed?
Yeah.
He's the one who made that calculation.
He did.
Invented that number. And, yeah, they invented that number. They went through drawings to figure out what content should have been in the building.
Yeah.
That's where that number comes from. It doesn't come from what they actually hauled away.
Yeah. Particularly, explainable since you got to compensate for the missing mass that was due to the pulverization, the dustification of the buildings.
Right. So he just went into, like, the building ingredients of what was used to make the building.
Yeah. Okay. What do we got here about a closer look at the psyops of 9/11?
This video is worth watching. It's a short, two-minute one, but I don't know if we should watch it or...
Sure. Let's go ahead and watch it. Okay, I'm starting it. Oh, this was Pataki.
He says 106 stories. 104.
Yeah, I lost my sound here. I'll put my phone up so we can hear the sound.
at the moment it was built. What happened to the concrete?
The concrete was pulverized, and I was down there Tuesday, and it was like you're on a foreign planet. All of Lower Manhattan, not just this site, from river to river, there was rock powder, 2-3 inches thick. The concrete was just pulverized. And what do you explain, Governor, the smoke that still comes out of the fire?
There's still fire down below. There is such an incredibly deep pile of rubble, and the tower goes down 5-6 stories underground that there's still fire underneath.
This is how it's been since day one.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And this is 6 weeks later, almost 6 weeks later.
And as we get closer, the center of this gets hotter and hotter. It's probably 1,500 degrees. We've had some small windows into what we saw was the core at some point, and it looked like an oven. You know, it was just roaring inside. It's just a bright, bright reddish orange color. See that stuff he's pulling out?
Oh, that's
we're gonna hold off on the water. See the stuff he's pulling out?
Yeah.
Red hot. If we hit it too much steam, you won't be able to see what he's doing.
Great.
You see how the debris is still smoking? That's when the fire is gonna still burning. 8 weeks later, we still got fires burning. Every now and then, one of the pieces of equipment will dig in, will open up a small area, the oxygen will rush in, and you'll get this plume of brown, black smoke coming up. That's because that fire just got more oxygen. So, I mean, these things are burning. At one point, I think they were about 2,800 degrees.
Underground fires, ignited by burning jet fuel, smoldered for months, fed by molten steel and buried carpeting, office furniture, wood paneling, and paper.
Still toasted is one of the biggest things. Out on the rubble, it's still, I believe, 1,100 degrees. Guys, the smell within a few hours.
You get down below and you see molten steel running down the channel rail. Like you're in a foundry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the more unusual artifacts to emerge from the rubble is this rock-like object that has come to be known as the meteorite.
It's this fused element of steel, molten steel, and concrete, and all of these things all fused by the heat into one single element.
And almost like a chunk of lava from Kilauea or Iceland, where they're very sharp but breakable shards on the end here.
Could you hear the sound?
I heard it.
Now, when the first guy says 1,500 degrees, you know, when they're talking about the grappler, I mean, that's preposterous if it, you know, freezes up at less than the boiling point of water or not much above it. I mean, that's really ridiculous.
And I've started making some comments below the box. I want to get a better transcript of what they're saying. This is just past.
Yeah.
You know, at what temperature do you cook a turkey in your oven?
Yeah, I know, what, 350, 400 or something?
You know, do you have a thermometer in it to make sure it gets 150 inside?
Right.
Says, you know, see that stuff he's pulling out right now? It's red hot?
Yeah.
I believe that's red rust.
Yeah. Yeah. And when he described the smoke coming up, it was sort of black or brown. It didn't sound like something that would, you know, be what you'd expect from molten metal.
He says reddish brown.
And one guy did say the temperature 2,700, which if it actually were molten metal, would be in the right vicinity. But, you know, that's just talking about what would be the temperature if it were molten.
My favorite part is about the steel-toed boots.
Oh, yeah. You're saying why aren't we cooking the feet off of the firemen then, huh?
He says still out of the rubble pile, it's still 1,100 degrees. The guy's boots just melt after a few hours or after 2 hours. You know, if you put a turkey in the boots, you know, short order. Why don't you be separated?
Too much. And of course, I love your photograph there too about the guys actually down in the sub basement. That was beneath the south tower, and you see those pools of water that aren't even percolating. They aren't steaming, and you see men walking around. And that's in the sub-basements.
Yeah, they're trying to find survivors, and, you know, there aren't any.
Okay, hang on, and we'll take a look at your next set of photographs. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Judy Wood. Stand by. My special guest today is Judy Wood, and we're discussing a new page she has on her website, which can be found at drjudywood.com/dirt4.html. Judy, we just had a note from Morgan Reynolds, who points out that on page 181, 182 of Debunking 9/11, Debunking, Leslie Robertson is quoted again, stating that as of 21 days after the attack, the fires were still burning and molten steel was still running, which it seems to me suggests that he was a part of the cover-up. That would be my inference based on what we're discovering.
Yep, and where's the, when they talk about the molten metal running down the channel, was it eventually going to run down into the basement into those puddles of water?
Yeah, and cause them to evaporate, bubble, whatever, all the whole bit, so.
You would have an explosion if you had if it was that hot and you put water in there.
Yeah, that's the point I made, too, about those who want to maintain that the bathtub was cracked and yet there was that molten metal, that we would have had these massive steam explosions, which, of course, didn't occur. So either we didn't have a rupture of the bathtub or we didn't have molten metal or both.
Right. And this next section is about that, questioning molten metal. And I have the first two pictures are taken in dry weather.
Okay.
The 15th and the 16th of September.
Right. I see the dates.
And you see in the background steam coming up, or what looks like steam. It's that.
Right, right.
And
what's the reddish stuff in the middle of figure 112?
That's rust.
Rust.
We're going to get to the rust.
Okay. I mean, I see an awful lot of rust.
Oh, yeah. Plenty. And you also notice that.
That is kind of interesting, Judy, that there should be so much rust. I mean, this is just a couple of days.
We'll get to that.
Okay, go on.
The dry weather, you have the fumes coming up. Wet weather, you don't.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah, and wet weather, you ought to have even more, of course, because it's going to bring about all the steam from the interaction with the water with the molten metal.
And if you click on figure 112.
Yeah, which one? You got two identified 112.
Oh, the one on the right?
Yeah.
You get a bigger one. And where they dump the dirt on top of the beams.
They're going to be dumping. Oh yeah, I see some dirt here.
And if that was hot, you'd have the beams would be dry and sizzling.
Uh huh.
Or you'd see some steam coming out from where the water ran down in the middle.
These two are identical, are they not?
Oh.
Those two photographs are the same.
One's a blow up of the other, I believe.
Yeah, one's cropped. Yeah, yeah, one's a little bit of a blow up. Right, right, right. Yeah, I got it.
It's not its final. Thing yet, but
yeah,
you have wet beams. You also notice they're wrinkly. You see those wrinkles?
Yeah, wrinkles right in the middle. Yeah, what's the 5.5 ton above it? There's some wrinkled.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's like the beams are starting to disintegrate.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a possibility. If it was overloaded from heat, it buckles in one place. It doesn't, buckle every inch.
Okay. Okay.
All right, we'll continue on with this same theme about the dirt versus the hosing down.
Yeah.
And then figures 110 and 112, you have, these with a kind of pea green background. You see a puddle in the foreground. This is in the basement of one of the towers.
This is actually in the basement of the North Tower.
Yeah. And
in the sub-basement.
Correct. And then you see some core columns across the pond there.
Yep.
Bright orange. And these nice rainbows, they're hosing this down, and you have water running down into the puddle through the wet dirt. And if you look at the picture 112, and you click on that one, make it big if you need.
Look, this is just curious, Judy, but you see to the left of that trooper, there's someone carrying a small child there. Who in the world could this be that would be down there? Well, I guess this is over a month. This is over a month later. This is a month and a half later.
Right. I call that the Gestapo picture.
Uh huh. Very curious.
And the picture on the right is from a little bit further to the. These are cut from the larger image, and you can go to the original source and get that. But for resolution, I've cut them down. But if you look on the other side, the right hand picture by that cone. And way over to the right edge, you see that steam-looking stuff coming out of the wet dirt.
Sure, yeah.
Make sense? And the water's running, the ground is so saturated, the water's running down into the puddle.
Yes. We're still on 112, right, on the right-hand side?
Right.
Yeah.
Get down up the hill on the dirt pile, and the water is so saturated, the dirt's so saturated that the...
Oh, I see on the upper left. Oh, I see on the left. Yeah, to the left of the marker, yeah.
And also, you know, why the rainbow is there, because they're hosing it down.
Uh-huh.
And then the saturated extra water comes leaching out into the puddle. So,
you know, Judy, that's great about the rainbow, because the rainbow is when you have mist, when you have light going through through mist. So that has to be, that can't be smoke. You don't have a rainbow in smoke.
If you looked at the bigger picture, you would see the guy holding the hose and all that.
Very interesting.
But the point is, the dirt is, you know, why is all that dirt there?
Yeah. Huge amount of dirt. Amount of dirt.
It's saturated.
Yeah.
They're still trying to, they're always hauling dirt out and hauling dirt in and, you know, changing dirt.
That must have driven the workers batty. I mean, unless they actually knew what they were doing, that they're bringing so much dirt in that they know they're going to have to take back out.
That looks like nice dirt there. It doesn't have debris in it. It looks like potting soil. But
uh-huh.
No stuff in the background.
Fairly high quality.
So go to the next picture. And here,
yeah, this is one of those, because we got support beams there.
And you have these workers with a torch, cutting torch or whatever, out there standing in the middle. And if that was hot, they'd look more like a grilled cheese sandwich.
That's right. That's true. It was as hot as being claimed.
Yeah, they're wearing coats and, you know, they're...
Yeah. That's good. And those beams aren't cot beams. They don't have any angles or anything.
Right. They're bolted together, and the bolts were broken free. For 115, you see a bunch of these grapplers out there with all this, steam-looking stuff coming out of the ground.
Yeah.
For them to drive out to that location, they would have had too much exposure to the heat and wouldn't be working anymore.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but look in the foreground, all that rust.
Yeah, I'm noticing that. Yeah, what's the date on this one? I blew it up, yeah.
Now,
it's 10-13, okay.
Yeah, the next picture is the key to it all, the best one of all. And this is, I believe, why that the Cheeto picture was useful for PSYOPs. Look at the rust. We're talking about 116.
Yep.
Look on the right-hand side. You see steel just turning to rust.
Right there in front of us.
And it's fuming upwards.
That chunk that's very red-brown. And here you got this weird-colored gas. Now, see, that's what he said when they opened it up. That's what he said came out.
Yeah, reddish
brown. With that reddish brown smoke. He was calling it smoke. But it's more this mist. It's this chemical residue from the demolecularization.
Yeah, and the picture right below that, of this Pepsi truck.
Yeah.
Why is it instantly rusted, you know, in the first hour probably?
Uh-huh.
It's not rusted everywhere.
Uh-huh. Well, I love this picture 116, Judy. This is really very, very, very interesting picture.
And you have the digger, I call it digger, out there, the grappler out there digging in it.
Yeah. I do think this is a telling photograph. I agree with you. This is a very telling photograph.
And this is from a government website.
Uh-huh. Judy, listen, I can't thank you enough. This is just the initiation. We're just getting warmed up. Tomorrow I'm going to have you back for the full show. I'm absolutely delighted with this. My special guest today, the second hour, has been Judy Wood. The first hour, Lorraine Moray. I'm very delighted that Judy will be back tomorrow for the whole show. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Thanks for listening.
You say goodbye.